From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Medal of Dishonor. Is NATO using radioactive weapons against Yugoslavia? And what about the bombs that continue to fall in Iraq? Today, we'll look at the ecological effects of the bombs. Also, paramilitaries in East Timor, rampage. Who's behind them? And what is the role of the Indonesian military? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Government buildings, a military barracks, a key bridge, and a chemical manufacturing town all were apparently targeted in NATO's latest airstrikes against Yugoslavia today. The state-run news agency says the bridge that was attacked spans the Danube and serves as a major link between Serbia and Croatia. It says it was only slightly damaged as in a similar attack 2 weeks ago. A television transmitter in Kosovo was also reportedly targeted earlier today, though it's not clear if it was hit. For its part, NATO says the overnight air operations were again affected by bad weather. It says all its aircraft returned safely. Meanwhile, NATO says it intends to bring U.S. Apache helicopters to Yugoslavia before the beginning of next week. That word comes today from NATO Secretary General Javier Solana. The alliance is sending some 24 Apaches to the Balkans. The low-flying tank busters will go after Yugoslav forces in Kosovo. And President Clinton is expected to approve soon a call-up of tens of thousands of reservists for Operation Allied Force. And he'll be sending Congress a request for money. Pentagon officials spent the weekend finalizing plans for calling up as many as 33,000 troops. Most would be from Air National Guard units. They're needed to service the 300 national warplanes Washington is sending to NATO for the air campaign against Yugoslavia. The president will also formally ask Congress this week for an emergency spending bill to cover the operation. It's expected to be close to $6 billion for the U.S. role in Allied airstrikes and refugee relief efforts. Yesterday, Clinton spoke by phone with the leaders of four countries bordering Yugoslavia, Hungary, Albania, Bulgaria, and Romania. Among the topics, how to help refugees. Meanwhile, Russia's defense minister says NATO is preparing to send ground troops into Yugoslavia. Igor Sergeyev doesn't cite the source of his information, but he says the troops could come in as either peacekeepers or combatants, and he says no final decision has been made. NATO says it has no intention of sending ground troops into combat in Yugoslavia, though it would deploy troops to implement a peace settlement. Meanwhile, Boris Yeltsin plans to speak to President Clinton today about NATO's air campaign in Yugoslavia, which Russia strongly opposes. Russian news agencies say Yeltsin plans to tell Clinton that Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic has no intention of backing down. The Serbs have once again shut off the refugee flow from Kosovo. They closed the main border crossing into Albania yesterday after breaking off diplomatic relations. And now a UN official says they also appear to be turning back refugees inside Kosovo. A UN spokesperson says one woman who arrived in Macedonia yesterday reported seeing two buses and a train turn back into the province. And he says he doesn't believe the incident is isolated. The United States wants NATO to plan ways of blocking deliveries of oil to Yugoslavia by sea, which have continued even as Allied warplanes bomb refineries and oil storage installations on land. This according to Allied officials talking to the New York Times. But the Kosovo campaign is a war fought by committee, in this case the 19-nation alliance, and NATO procedures require a plan acceptable to all. And this news on the Supreme Court in a piece by Linda Greenhouse, beginning on Wednesday with a case that some lawyers would have labeled the Brown versus Board of Education of the disability rights movement. The Supreme Court is embarking on an unusually extensive review of a single federal statute, the Americans with Disabilities Act. Greenhouse writes, the justice's decision to hear four Disability Act cases over a two-week period reflects the fact that the full dimensions of this far-reaching civil rights law remain uncharted even after nearly 10 years on the books. And this news from upstate New York, anti-abortion protesters vow to take their campaign to the high schools of Buffalo today as their week-long Operation Save America continues. Organizers say they'll be promoting abstinence while displaying pictures of aborted fetuses as part of a so-called truth campaign. And in Salt Lake City, Daniel Coben Jr. says he's upset about last week's Mormon library shooting. Coben tells a local newspaper that he went into the library to pick up a book and came out to find a huge hole in his truck. A bomb squad blew the hole in the yellow moving van, which was parked outside the site of last Thursday's deadly shooting.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough. No politician bent enough to bury your story, to keep it from us. Love from a short distance.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Warning that NATO could cause a huge ecological catastrophe, Yugoslav authorities are asking NATO not to hit a chemical plant near central Belgrade. A Belgrade health official said that if it's bombed, the plant could release a cloud with a deadly dose of hydrofluoride, an acid used to manufacture washing detergents. The officials say the effects would be deadly within a 19-mile radius, and its toxic effects would reach 60 miles away. The factory has been lit by floodlights for NATO planes to clearly see it. Meanwhile, thick black smoke mixed with choking fumes rose above an area targeted by a NATO attack on an oil storage depot and nitrogen fertilizer plant just 6 miles northwest of Belgrade. State media warned residents of the capital to cover their mouths with handkerchiefs as a precaution against hazardous fumes, but a thunderstorm prevented any chance of them reaching the city. An immense fire also sent pillars of smoke into the sky after a strike on a refinery in Novi Sad. This comes as confusion deepens over the deadly NATO attack on a Kosovo refugee convoy, with NATO saying yesterday a tape of a pilot it presented after the attack may not be that of the pilot that bombed the convoy. More than 60 Kosovar civilians were killed in that bombing. According to NATO officials, they chose this tape because it was clear and available and served as an example of how a pilot reacts during a ground attack over Kosovo. But the pilot in the tape talks about hitting a military target, whereas the pilot that bombed the convoy did not hit a military target. Critics are now saying that NATO produced the wrong pilot because it made for a better story. Paul Watson, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who's in Kosovo and went to the site of the bombing, said he'd examined fragments of the bomb that indicated it was a U.S. cluster bomb, which contains about a dozen smaller bombs and sends shrapnel within a radius the size of 2 football fields. We're going to talk now about the environmental effects of the intensive NATO-U.S. bombing of Yugoslavia. We're joined by a number of people. We're going to start off, though, with Robert Hayden, who's director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. He's been deeply involved in attempts to mediate the crisis in Kosovo, bringing political leaders from all sides and regularly visiting the region. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Professor Hayden.
Thanks, Amy.
Talk first about your picture of what we are just hearing about now and seeing pictures of on television. For example, this weekend, 500 missions, as they're called, Alliance jets, in the 24-hour period that ended yesterday afternoon, and then the refinery blown up and a number of other industrial sites.
Sure. I'll give you two simple words, war crimes. I mean, you have a mission that is absolutely out of control. What this war was supposed to be about, according to Clinton when he launched it, was to prevent a humanitarian catastrophe and to stabilize the Balkans. He's provoked a humanitarian catastrophe. Now he's provoking, he is causing, not provoking, but actually causing, actually making an ecological catastrophe. And in terms of the stabilization of the Balkans are less stable with every damned airstrike. And that that can produce a general Balkans war, which could immediately be a general European war. This is a mission that was brought to you by people who were either cravenly incompetent or simply callous. There is no second choice, although the third choice, rather, though those two choices are not mutually exclusive. It is a The Clinton administration has turned a tragedy into a catastrophe, and it is becoming a catastrophe not just for the ethnic Albanians of Kosovo and for the Serbs of Serbia, but for the entire Southeast Europe. We are starting to do what Southeast Europe, what we did, we Americans did to Southeast Asia 30 years ago.
Can you explain what it means, for example, to blow up a refinery and where the refinery that we've seen pictures of is?
Pančevo. The Pančevo refinery is a couple of miles away from Belgrade, which is one thing. Belgrade's a city of 2 million people, Belgrade in the regions, but it is quite literally on the Danube River. There are now reports of a 12-mile slick of chemicals and God knows what else on the Danube, heading for the Black Sea, and this is directly the result of the NATO airstrikes. Nonsense. This is military aggression. These are air attacks. It's not the euphemistic here. If this had not been damage caused intentionally by American aircraft, the whole world would be if this plant had blown up through an industrial accident, the world would be aghast at a major ecological catastrophe. You'll be interested, of course, in NATO's response when the Serbs have pointed out the huge amounts of toxic materials being released in the air. They say, oh, there's much more smoke than that coming from burning villages in Kosovo, which is, of course, even if it were true, which it's not, it would be irrelevant.
Robert Hayden, when you talk about war crimes at the same time that we're seeing the burning refinery and hearing about the 500 missions that took place over the weekend until yesterday afternoon, we're also hearing NATO say that they are looking at pictures of aerial pictures of what they assume are mass graves in Kosovo. I think they're saying now that they see something like 43 of them.
Yeah, let's be clear here. Milosevic is a brutal, evil dictator. There's no question about that. And the things that Serb paramilitaries are doing on the ground is, I'm sure, also quite brutal and terrible. All right, let's be clear on this. Now, as for NATO reports on atrocities, yes, reported. I don't know what's in those pictures that NATO is showing, but it seems to me, and it seems to some people even in the Pentagon, that this is implausible that they are mass graves. Single graves in a row from an army that's under attack? This doesn't sound likely. NATO's reports of atrocities early in the war were, in fact, lies. We heard from NATO, for example, that named ethnic Albanians, some of whom I knew, by the way, so I was upset by this news, had been executed. They had not been. They popped up later giving news conferences. We heard that Ibrahim Rugova, the elected president of the Kosovo Albanians, was wounded in hiding and his house was burned. Well, he's in that house now, clearly under house arrest, but in the house. We had heard that, that 20,000 people were being kept in a concentration camp, quote unquote, in the soccer stadium in Pristina. Clearly not true. What we're seeing here is a massive propaganda campaign. Now, look, as I say, I'm very sure that what is going on the ground is brutal. Of course, what is going on the ground in Kosovo right now cannot be distinguished from what was going on the ground in the Serbian occupied areas of Croatia in August 1995. In the course of the expulsion of 250,000 Serbs from Croatia, but that attack was done with American military training, military intelligence, military support, and diplomatic cover, so that was not genocide, much less ethnic cleansing. This is what is going on here. NATO is using this as an excuse, but they're all unconfirmed. It's fabulous stuff, actually, because it's so transparent if you look at it. NATO telling the New York Times, for example, that, well, we believe these reports of rape. Oh, why do you believe them? Well, because of the source. What's the source? Well, we can't reveal the source. I mean, give me a break.
We're talking to Robert Hayden. He's director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. He's been deeply involved in attempts to mediate the crisis in Kosovo. We're going to be talking about the issue of depleted uranium and is it being used at this point. And we'll be speaking with a community activist, a Persian Gulf War veteran who has things to say about what's going on in Iraq now at the same time as Yugoslavia. And We'll continue that discussion after the break. But Robert Hayden, I didn't want to go without talking about the latest news of Serbia severing diplomatic relations with Albania for aiding Kosovo rebels and cooperating with Western allies. Apparently, also, Bulgaria is considering a NATO request to allow warplanes to use its airspace, and what all this means in terms of the possibility of the airstrikes ending in some kind of diplomatic accord being reached.
Well, it makes it all more distant. But look, when I said we have the prospects of a greater Balkans war, this seems to be what Bill Clinton wants to do. If he doesn't want to do it, he's taking every step he can to do it. So as I say, take your choice, either gross incompetence or gross callousness. There's no third. In terms of Serbia, Yugoslavia breaking relations with Albania, this shouldn't surprise anybody. The Prime Minister of Albania has announced that Albania wants to have Kosovo added to Albania, and Albania has simply turned over all of its facilities, all of its airspace to NATO, which is mounting a war of aggression against Yugoslavia. And it is, in fact, a war of aggression. And I would remind you that the Nuremberg war crimes trials in their first decision said that a war of aggression was not only an international crime, but it is the highest international crime. We also have a situation in which Hungary, having just joined NATO, is suddenly being told that it has to make war against its neighbor. The United States really doesn't care about the Balkans. Let's be clear about this, right? I mean, we're perfectly happy, just as we, the United States, were perfectly happy to kill 2 million Vietnamese, and to say nothing of set up the situation that brought Pol Pot to power in Cambodia, destroyed Laos. We were perfectly willing to do that. The United States is perfectly willing to destroy the Balkans, quite literally, to destroy the economy, the ecology, and the political structures of the Balkans that have let these people live in peace most of their times. As you can hear, I am appalled. I'm worse than appalled. I don't know what to say. It's rare that I'm rendered speechless, but the extraordinary actions of the Clinton administration render me speechless. You know, it was said by Clausewitz that war is diplomacy by other means, but these other means are destroying Southeast Europe as we speak, and they came about because the Clinton administration abandoned diplomacy for war, and it was a diplomacy that was failed. If you read the Rambouillet text, which we could never say is an agreement, it was never agreed to. Not only was it a fraud in the constitutional structures, which simply said that Serbia, Yugoslavia just has to write off 20% of its territory, and that's some of the most symbolically sacred to all Serbs, kind of like Jerusalem for Jews, Kosovo for Serbs, simply had to write it off because it wouldn't be part of Serbia anymore. Officially, we'd pretend that it would be, but it actually wouldn't be. But also the military annex, which is what this was, the bombing was provoked because the Serbs said, look, we'll talk about political deals, but the military annex never. Read the military annex to Rambouillet. The military annex would have put all of, not just Kosovo, but all of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia under NATO occupation. Under that military annex, NATO forces would be empowered to go anywhere they wanted in all of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia without hindrance. They would be able to arrest anyone whom they wanted to arrest. They could not be questioned by any authority or in any court whatsoever. And they would have the power to control the entire electromagnetic spectrum for communications. I mean, quite literally military occupation by NATO. Is it really surprising the Serbs couldn't sign it? Of course it was, and it was designed so they couldn't sign it. But we have the Clinton administration that developed a diplomacy that seems to have been intended to have produced this war. And now the Clinton administration's actions seem determined to produce a wider war.
Why would the Clinton administration want to produce a war?
Boy, you know what? You got me there. And as I say, you have to go back to the simple principles of incompetence. Never assume competence on the part of these guys. To give I'm sorry if it's alarmist, but to simply go back to the start of World War I, and this will just take a minute, World War I didn't start in Sarajevo with the assassination of the Archduke. That was on May 28th. World War I started on August 1st when the Austro-Hungarian Empire used the assassination in Sarajevo in exactly the same way that Lyndon Johnson used the Tonkin Gulf incident, which was as an excuse to do what they wanted to do anyway, which was attack Serbia, or in Johnson's case, attack North Vietnam. So that World War One actually started when the Austro-Hungarian army invaded Serbia, shelled Belgrade. The Serbs called for help from the Russians, the Austrians to the Germans. The Russians called the French called the British. 20 million deaths later, you had the Versailles Agreement, which, you know, set the stage for World War Two. But remember, the Austrians didn't set out to start World War One. They only set out to crush Serbia, and they were utterly incompetent. Well, you know, we're talking about the Clinton administration here.
Robert Hayden, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. But when we come back, we'll be joined by several other people to go back to environmental issues and particularly take on the issue of depleted uranium. In fact, it's an issue you raised on a cable television network this weekend and got cut off in the process. Robert Hayden, director of the Center for Russian East European Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, is with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll discuss with him and others depleted uranium. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with our discussion of the bombing of Yugoslavia and look now at the issue of the environment, and particularly at one issue, at depleted uranium, Robert Hayden, director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, is continuing to join us. Professor Hayden, you raised this issue. Where and what happened?
I raised this issue on a program on MSNBC. I think it was on News Chat with John Gibson, and I raised this issue, and boy, did he stop that quickly. He said, no, you know, what did he say? Something along the lines of, that hasn't been verified or something.
Well, explain exactly what you said.
Well, I would have to remember exactly what I said, but what I said was that, there was an interesting and scary report out of Skopje, Macedonia, that the natural science faculty of the University of Skopje was reporting an increase in their measurements of ambient radiation levels since the war began. But MSNBC found that too hot to handle.
Well, let's talk about the issue of depleted uranium. Recently, many scientists, health professionals, and environmental activists are demanding to know whether NATO is using weapons that contain depleted uranium, a radioactive metal that's causing birth defects, stillbirths, and high rates of cancer amongst other people, Iraqis, Gulf War veterans, and residents of a small New Mexico town located just a few miles from where the military conducts tests on depleted uranium. So far, both NATO and the Pentagon have refused to say whether they're using bullets tipped with depleted uranium against the Serb army. But many say that there are weapons that are actually containing depleted uranium. We're also joined by Rosalie Bertel, who's an epidemiologist and president of the International Institute of Concern for Public Health, also editor-in-chief of the International Perspectives in Public Health, and she joins us from Canada. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dr. Bertel.
Good morning.
Can you tell us what you understand would be the vehicle for carrying depleted uranium in Yugoslavia?
Well, in the first place, it's clear that they have used it because depleted uranium is used as a ballast on the cruise missiles and Tomahawk missiles. It's also the usual ordnance used for the Apache helicopter and for the Warthog A-10. That's so, you know, the They've obviously used it at least as a ballast, and they're most likely using it as weapons. The best statement we could get was that it was there on the battlefield and that they would use whatever they needed to win. You know, that's not exactly saying it, but it's pretty close.
From whom was that statement?
It was a statement which I got from the UK, from there quizzing the NATO headquarters in Belgium.
We asked the Pentagon to join us on today's show, and they almost did, but then called back and said, the Army spokesperson who was going to come on, that the Army was not using depleted uranium, so there was no reason to come on the show, that they were not using it in Yugoslavia. But, in fact, we're involved with two bombings right now. One is
the Air Force using it.
That's right.
You've got to watch your language.
And when we called the Pentagon to ask for a spokesperson. They gave us an Army spokesperson. He said, well, since the Army isn't using it right now, we won't go on to talk about it. There's nothing to talk about.
Yeah.
But we do know that depleted uranium has been used in Iraq. And it's not just the bombing of Yugoslavia that we've been talking about.
They used it in Bosnia also.
That's right, in the 95.
And how was it used in Bosnia?
The same as Iraq, but not at the same amount. Actually, Iraq was not the first place it was used. It was the first place it was used extensively. The Russians used it in Afghanistan, for example, but nobody used it to the extent that the U.S. and U.K. did in Iraq. What's even more outrageous is after doing this, they are still, it's what, 9 years after that war, and they have still not properly tested any of the military, which is unbelievable. Even the men with depleted uranium fragments in their bodies that are in the special testing at the VA administration in Baltimore, they're still now today testing for natural uranium and have not done the proper test to determine whether or not it was depleted.
I want to bring in Dr. Bertel and Professor Hayden Paul Sullivan, who's with the National Gulf War Resource Center in Washington, D.C. He himself is a Persian Gulf War vet. Can you talk about the work that your group has done on depleted uranium?
Yes, Amy. What we have right now is the Pentagon doing the best at spin control to avoid additional damage. During the Gulf War, the United States military used 640,000 pounds of radioactive toxic waste in the form of depleted uranium. It was the National Gulf War Resource Center that forced the Pentagon to make that admission. Another important concession that we got from the Pentagon was the National Gulf War Resource Center forced the military to admit that 400,000 U.S. troops entered into contaminated areas. Some of those troops camped in contaminated areas for up to 2 months. So obviously the amount of contamination and the number of those contaminated is very high as a result of the Gulf War, and we believe that depleted uranium is one of several factors that need to be thoroughly studied to understand why so many Gulf War veterans are sick.
How many Gulf War veterans are sick?
Well, what we know right now is out of 700,000 American troops who were in the Kuwait, Iraq, Saudi Arabian area in 1990 and 1991, 253,000 have sought medical care of one kind or of another. We need to separate out about 110,000 say that their illnesses or medical problems are related directly to their service in the Gulf War. And one new statistic, Amy and Rosalie, you'll be very interested in. The Department of Veterans Affairs on January 1st acknowledged that Gulf War veterans, those who were in the combat theater between 90 and 91, are 39% more likely to have a military-related medical problem as compared to their non-deployed peers. So what we have is a clear statistical evidence shows that Gulf War veterans are more likely to be ill, and that the government has actually tied the illnesses to military service in the Gulf, and we see the numbers continuing to climb.
I'd just like to inject
Dr. Bertel.
Something here. You said in your introduction that depleted uranium was connected with birth defects and cancer. That's part of the propaganda because they're only looking at first cause of death when they focus on cancer. That's an administrative decision. Actually, uranium does a lot of other damage in the body. It can cause emphysema, for example. It can cause damage to the lungs, the liver, the kidney, blood, bone. And these all have sequelae, which are measurable if they care to measure it. But what they've done is they've said the worst effect and the only one we should worry about is cancer, and therefore they're ignoring the rest. And it's the other things that the vets are suffering from.
Let's bring Damasio Lopez into the conversation. He's a researcher with Revisioning New Mexico, an organization that works on the effects of depleted uranium. And he recently finished a study on depleted uranium and went to an international conference on DU in Iraq. Damasio Lopez, what have you found? And can you make the connection to depleted uranium dropping on other countries and how it is used and affects people here in the United States?
Thank you, Amy. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I'm really not surprised to hear that the Pentagon is denying the use of depleted uranium in Yugoslavia. I expect to hear that kind of reaction from them. Obviously, from all the information that we've gotten from Iraq, people are starting to wise up, you might say, about this weapon. And they certainly don't want to alarm the American public to think that we're contemplating a ground war where we're going to send American troops into a radioactive battlefield. I think the American public simply won't put up with that. So this is damage control, like Paul Sullivan was saying earlier. They're trying to keep the American public from realizing that not only do they intend to use depleted uranium weapons in Yugoslavia, but have been using them consistently since 1994 when they bombed Bosnia. Basically, we were talking about
now,
armored
again,
tanks.
At this point, they are saying, NATO is saying that they will not confirm or deny, and the Army said that they're not using it at this point. But
okay.
After all, it is airstrikes that are going on right
sure.
now.
Well, you know, just to get the record straight here in terms of whether or not they're using DU in Yugoslavia, the fact is that they are. Depleted uranium is one of the components of the Tomahawk missile. It's used as a ballast and a nose cone on the Tomahawk, and it's also used on the Shram II and the Pershing and the Phoenix, just about all the cruise missiles.
What do you mean a ballast?
It's to balance the actual projectile as it goes through the air. It's like the Boeing 747 uses 1,500 kilos of depleted uranium to balance the plane. And the same thing is done with the missiles. They use the depleted uranium because it's so heavy to balance the missile as it goes through the air, and they use it on the nose cone. And then, of course, everybody knows what happens when these cruise missiles hit their target. They totally pulverize. I suspect that in August, when I go to Yugoslavia. I plan to go to Belgrade, and I plan to go in with a team of people with radiation detectors and check it out.
How do you plan to do that?
Well, I plan to go there just like I did when I went to Baghdad back in December. I just plan to go there and get this information. And then the following week, I'm going to the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland, to the UN Subcommission on Human Rights, and I plan to go there and report on what I find in Yugoslavia.
Can you talk about the connection to your community in New Mexico?
Certainly. In Socorro, back in 1986, I discovered that they were using depleted uranium weapons in testing right next to the town of Socorro, 2 miles from the town, actually, and it was on top of the city water supply. They picked the most beautiful place and the most precious place to the community to do this testing. And they'd begun in 1972, but nobody in the community knew that they were using uranium bullets. They thought they were conventional weapons. And then in 1986, quite a few years later, I found this out. And during that whole time, every time they would go out there and test their weapons and hit hard targets alongside the mountains, the prevailing winds would bring the smoke with radioactive particles in it over the community. And the first house it would cross would be my house, where my parents live and my brothers and everyone else. And in 1986, I discovered that they were using depleted uranium there, and I confronted them, and they became very belligerent when I brought this up to them, as you can imagine, because they had been actually deceiving the public for so long. And unfortunately, there were politicians that were also in cahoots with them, and it's hard for them to do all these things without having some crooked politicians go along with them, or politicians thinking that economic development is going to get them reelected again. And so they kind of sell this project as an economic development project, or they did in Socorro. But when we found out about it in 1986, confronted them, and it became a real battle, and they denied it, and they said it was up to us to find out whether the stuff was radioactive, and it was up to us to find out if there was any problems in the community. We appealed to the Environmental Department of the State of New Mexico for a health study. They wouldn't do a thing either. It was locked in. It was like, you know, the system was protecting this particular type of testing. And as time went by, I began to find out why they were doing this. They were violating international laws and subject to fines and cleanups and all kinds of things. And so I found this out just 2 years ago. There was a resolution introduced at the Human Rights Subcommission in Geneva, Switzerland, about weapons of mass destruction, and guess what weapon was included? It was depleted uranium, and they've been conducting studies for the past 2 years on depleted uranium use and across the world, and they've condemned it, and they classified depleted uranium as a weapon of mass destruction.
Paul Sullivan, the discussion now in the mainstream media and around the world is ground troops. The spectrum is very narrow. It's, do we escalate from airstrikes to ground troops? It is very rarely do we hear a peace activist talking about the non-militaristic options at this point. It's just how far do we go from here? But you are a Persian Gulf War veteran. And
I'm talking to Paul Sullivan.
Yes.
Okay.
You're a Persian Gulf War veteran, Paul, and you've seen how many tens of thousands of Gulf vets have come down ill. What would you say to soldiers today who could be brought into the conflict, U.S. soldiers?
Amy, you pose a question that I had the opportunity to pose directly to the Undersecretary of the Army, Bernard Rosker, who has a dual role as the head of the Office of the Special Assistant for Gulf War Illnesses at the Pentagon. Bernard Rosker was asked by me, the Executive Director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, as well as by Chris Corkvin, the President of the National Gulf War Resource Center, will U.S. troops be trained regarding depleted uranium? The answer to that was yes, they will be trained, because the National Gulf War Resource Center pushed through last year an addition to the defense bill requiring training for all U.S. troops regarding the hazards of radioactive toxic waste in the form of depleted uranium. Well, what we then asked is, can you show us that the training has commenced and who is accountable for the training? And then their house of cards fell apart. The Department of Defense could not provide us with any videos. They couldn't provide us with any written material. And in fact, during the meeting we held with the Pentagon last week, they advised us that depleted uranium training is not considered a priority by commanders. Therefore, it leads the Gulf War veteran community to believe that the Pentagon leadership under Rosker is unable to convince the military leadership that depleted uranium is an issue.
Paul Sullivan,
we also found out
we're going to have wrap up the discussion as we move on to another critical issue that has happened this weekend. But I want to give people a chance to get information from the National Gulf War Resource Center. Where can they call or go on the web?
Sure. The National Gulf War Resource Center has a depleted uranium case narrative. It can be found at www.gulfweb.org/NGWRC. And that's where we actually have the document showing that the Pentagon knew that depleted uranium was a very significant health hazard before the Gulf War, in fact, dating to 1961.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. It's only the start of the discussion. Again, we don't know the extent to which depleted uranium is being used in Yugoslavia, though it has been in previous attacks. And we do know that it has been used in Iraq. And let's also not forget that there is a war on two fronts. The U.S. and NATO are bombing Yugoslavia, and the U.S. continues to bomb Iraq, although it gets almost no attention. And I thank you all for being with us. Damasio Lopez of Revisioning New Mexico, Paul Sullivan, National Gulf War Resource Center, Dr. Rosalie Bartel, who is president of the International Institute of Concern for Public Health and editor-in-chief of International Perspectives in Public Health. And thank you to Professor Robert Hayden, director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll find out what happened in East Timor this weekend, paramilitaries rampaging through the country. Stay with us.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story, to keep it from us.
Bury your story and keep it from us.
Love from a short distance. Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, over the weekend, Timorese paramilitaries rampaged through East Timor, killing scores of people, mainly pro-independence activists. Just a few hours before this show, I got through to Dili and spoke with Billy Nessen, who is a U.S. researcher who is currently in East Timor. I spoke to him in the capital, Dili, and asked him what happened this weekend.
This was Saturday, our Saturday. A rally was held by several paramilitary groups organized by the Indonesian military. The groups, the participants probably numbered about 1,500. They rallied in front of the provincial governor's mansion under the careful direction of the military, and then rampaged through the city of the capital of Dili, burning a number of houses, one marketplace, attacking the homes of well-known pro-independence leaders, killing an estimated 13 people, but the real figures are not known at this point. It could be as high as 100, but there are other estimates by people of about 30. There's also been some shooting by the military of people, although once again we're not sure how many people were killed by them. And how many wounded. That was 2 days ago. Yesterday there were more attacks by paramilitary groups on neighborhoods in Dili. At least three people wounded. One, I think, may have died overnight. And then once again, some shooting by the military of independent supporters. Independent supporters have I would say universally, stayed inside their homes, trying to avoid any sort of provocation. The paramilitary members are carrying, most of them carry some sort of modern firearms, but others have traditional weapons. Many of these are obviously newly acquired AK-47s and M-16s. We do know from talking to people that these guns were given to them by the military over the last few weeks. All this is said in the context of last week's massacre in Lakisa, a town west of Dili, the most important town on the northern coast, west of the capital. An estimated 25 to 200 people were killed there after two attacks by paramilitary groups on people sheltering in the priest's house in the church. They were driven out of the church by tear gas fired into the buildings, into the grasp. The killing, really a killing field. I saw blood, more blood than I've ever seen in my whole life, pooled on the ground, walls, just white walls, stained red. We don't know the exact number because that attack created thousands of refugees, some to the forest, others to Dili. But there are reports of the military and paramilitary groups carting away many bodies. Also, 2 days ago in Lakisa, we do know that the area was cordoned off. And of course, no outsiders allowed in. And report that five truckloads of bodies were transported out of there, and that dogs are were chewing on the bodies of dead people in the streets of Lakisa. One traveler who went through there yesterday said that the town is utterly deserted. Also reports from many places in the country. In the southern town of Swai, we know that a couple of university students on a sort of a practical a practice, we'll call it, part of their university education were shot and killed by paramilitary there. They were told that last year you had your demonstrations, this year we are having ours and we will kill you. Same source told me that most of the youth of that town have fled to the forest. They are being impressed into service by the paramilitary group operating there, a group called Mahidi. But that sort of impressment is going on all over. Forced threats of burning their families' homes if they don't join. Others are receiving money, the more sort of hardcore. I should add that of these 1,500 paramilitaries going around Dili, it's pretty clear that it's just a small number who are actually doing anything, that most of them are along for the ride and don't seem too happy about it. I was told by some of them that they are pro-independence supporters, but what can they do? They're from, I'm from a small village. And they come there and force us to join them. The images being conveyed by TV and the many of the newspaper reports are of East Timorese fighting amongst themselves. This is, first, it's not true in one sense because the pro-independence people, the overwhelming majority here, I dare to say 98-99%, are not fighting back. They are trying to keep the situation calm. The second part of that is that this is just what the Indonesian military wants to convey to the rest of the world, that it's something like Ambon or Kalimantan, where primitive people employing primitive weapons are fighting each other. Once again, the old image of a civil war if Indonesia leaves, which was the rationale for Indonesia's original invasion in 1975. There was a civil war then. We know now, and people knew then, that that civil war was fomented by Indonesia. And so the situation right now is fairly calm here. There are rallies throughout the country by pro-integration paramilitary, pro-Indonesian paramilitary groups. And most important to remember is that the army is directing all of this, and they, in a country where weapons are supposedly not allowed, these men are going around with automatic weapon supply, we know supplied by the military.
Which takes us back to the day you described, Saturday, 1,500 of these militiamen in front of the palace where the Indonesian military resides. What did the Indonesian military do? Reading the reports, the governor, Abilio Suarez, who works for the Indonesians, were there. Senior Indonesian military commanders were also there. They didn't stop these people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what you had were, in military formation, the militiamen or paramilitary men holding automatic weapons and some wooden guns and other things. And then around them, at a distance of let's say, 30 meters, 30 yards, were what are called intel agents, East Timorese and Javanese Indonesians who work for intelligence services here. And amongst them, they're in plain clothes, amongst them were uniformed military officers with radios who periodically went over and spoke to the well-dressed paramilitary leaders who were directing, who were holding, staging the rally.
Billy Nessen is an American researcher in Dili, East Timor, talking about what happened this weekend. More than 1,000 Timorese paramilitary going around not only Dili but other parts of East Timor this weekend. Scores of people have died as a result, most of those targeted pro-independence activists. Billy Nessen, in another part of the conversation, talked about what happened at one of the independence leaders' houses. His name is Manuel Carrascalo. He had about 120 refugees in his house who had fled other parts of Timor because of the paramilitary violence, and the paramilitaries went into the house and killed a number of the people there, as well as Manuel Carrascalo's adopted teenage son. Well, we're joined right now by Alan Nairn, journalist and activist. We covered East Timor together in 1990, in 1991, and 1994. In 1991, we witnessed and survived a massacre in East Timor where we saw the Indonesian military gun down scores of Timorese. Ultimately, they killed more than 270 of them. They beat us up and they fractured Alan's skull. Alan, this paramilitary violence of the past weekend, can you explain exactly what's behind it and what can be done in this country?
Well, these are, in effect, death squads set up and run by the Indonesian military. The Indonesian regime apparently has decided to get out of Timor. They've announced a UN-supervised vote for July in which the Timorese will be able to choose whether or not they want to be part of Indonesia or opt for independence. But as a parting shot, they have loosed these squads to take revenge on the Timorese, who have defeated them politically and humiliated the mighty Indonesian army in the eyes of the world. On Friday, the day on Friday, and then again on Saturday, when the rampage started in Dili, there were top Indonesian generals supervising the paramilitaries, General Zaki Makarem, the former head of BIA military intelligence, a close protege of U.S. Intelligence, Kiki Sayanakri. These are top figures in the Indonesian intelligence establishment. As the militia leadership on Saturday was publicly speaking, calling on members to eliminate any opponent of the Jakarta regime, Zaki and Sayanakri were looking on. As the militias rampaged through the streets, they were given assistance by troops. They were getting high fives. The guns they were using, many of them had been given to them by SGI, the Timorese-based intelligence service of the military. Many of these guns had been stockpiled for as much as 10 months. They had been, interestingly enough, stored in boxes that were manufactured by Timorese political prisoners. This is a long-planned operation. I think in part it's trying to send a message to activists within Indonesia in places like Aceh, Area in Jaya. We may let Timor go, but if you even think of independence, if you even think of freedom, this is what you have to look forward to.
What makes you think that Indonesia is going to let East Timor go at this point? If Indonesia is behind this violence, if, as Billy Nessen says, maybe they'll allow a vote to go forward and they'll maybe even pull out themselves, but with a paramilitary presence terrorizing people, ultimately the people may vote not for independence, as more than 90% of the people wanted, at least from our trips there and talking to people and everything that we have gathered.
The regime has already committed itself internationally to a vote, and they need to cut Timor loose because they're fighting for their own life within Indonesia. The police state is in danger. They're facing a slow-motion uprising from the Indonesian democracy movement. They're besieged. They've paid such a high price with the grassroots activism here, mobilizing a cutoff of much of the U.S. Weaponry and training. Heavy international criticism. Timor is more trouble than it's worth. But they are taking the revenge on the Timorese as a final act. And the U.S., at least the U.S. military, is giving tacit consent. Elements of the State Department have protested, but Admiral Blair, who's commander of the U.S. forces in the Pacific, based out of Hawaii, visited with Wiranto, the Indonesian commanding general and defense minister, the day after the Likisa massacre. They talked. The slaughter continued. This past Tuesday, Wiranto met with Colonel Suratman, the local Timor commander. They discussed the paramilitary situation. The slaughter still continued. The U.S. military is continuing to ship in weapons and spare parts to this day. People who want to stop this should contact Secretary of Defense William Cohen. He and his department appeared to be the main obstacle to reversing the U.S. position now. Cohen's office number is 703-692-7100 at the Pentagon. That's 703-692-7100.
You don't think he's a little distracted right now by the NATO airstrikes?
Well, it's it's impossible for one individual to preside over two killings at once. But there's a big bureaucracy there.
It's three, actually. We've got Iraq.
Yeah, a few dozen. And they take notes. They pay attention. The number, phone, 703-692-7100. The fax is 703-697-9080. That's Secretary of Defense William Cohen.
And the U.S. is continuing to arm the Indonesian military.
Yes, this year at least $106 million in commercial weapons sales are due. The Pentagon is pushing to openly renew the military training that Congress cut off. But I think Congress will be very angry about these paramilitary death squad attacks, and there may be moves to sever the aid, but the Pentagon will fight it.
Alan Aaron, I want to thank you for being with us. Alan Aaron, activist and journalist, has covered East Timor extensively. Well, that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Thanks to Joe Gill, who engineered from Washington, D.C. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York.